When was Jesus born? When did he die and rise from the grave? And what does the timing of these events have to do with Christian theology and practice for the last 2,000 years? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December is titled, When Was Jesus Really Born? It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or you can check out When Was Jesus Really Born at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, When Was Jesus Really Born?
You do claim that all of your books are based on fact. Tell us, though, what is the fact and what is the fiction in this book?
The documents, the locations, these are all real things. I want people to know that when this fictional character or any of the fictional characters enter a church, that church really exists. When they look at a parchment, that parchment is real. Of course, you know, whatever ideas they may draw, you know, those are their own.
That's Dan Brown, author of, well, his latest bestseller, Inferno, including other bestsellers, we know them, The Da Vinci Code, and so forth, speaking with The Guardian, talking about the factuality, or what he would say is the factual basis for his latest novel, Inferno. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Paul Meyer joins us here for the first half hour to review not only Dan Brown's Inferno, but also get his thoughts on Bill O'Reilly's Killing Jesus and Reza Aslan's book that tries to cast Jesus in what the author says is a truly historical light. The book is called Zealot. We'll get all of that in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway joins us in the second half hour. She's senior editor for The Federalist. We're going to talk about, well, the reaction is varied, actually. As the day goes by, the reaction kind of unfolds and flowers. A&E, that television channel, suspended Duck Dynasty's Phil Robertson. He's the father of the Duck Dynasty clan. He made comments in an interview with GQ magazine about homosexuality. He's suspended from the program, and many see this as the height of intolerance or the new tolerance. Molly will discuss that with us in about a half hour. And then in the second hour of the program, we'll go through listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at @issuesetc. If you'd like to leave your reaction to A&E's channel of suspension of Phil Robertson from Duck Dynasty, you can do so at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest. He's professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University, and he's author of numerous books, including his latest, The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
A recent review that you have written of Dan Brown's Inferno, you conclude by saying that the novel kind of has an immoral conclusion. What do you mean by that?
Well, at first, the heavy in the novel comes across with a cockamamie idea of sterilizing one-third of the world's population without their knowing it. And, of course, at first, everybody regards this as horror. But yet, toward the end of the book, even the good guys in the book say, yeah, we got to do something about this horrible problem of overpopulation in the world. And for that reason, they're going to loose a virus which will, again, unbeknownst to the, and there's no way to figure out who's going to get the virus because it's randomized, you might say, in the various medications that are around. And one-third of the population, the male population, will be sterilized, so that'll help cut down the horrendous overpopulation problems of this world. And so I would say anybody who's getting some kind of medication to sterilize himself is not exactly following any kind of moral pattern.
Okay, what's the premise of Dan Brown's latest, The Inferno?
Well, the premise is, in fact, the old worry about overpopulation in the world and the continual fight, you might say, between Roman Catholicism in terms of birth control and the WHO, the World Health Organization. Now, many Protestants, of course, will sympathize with the WHO against Roman Catholicism in terms of birth control, but others do not. And so automatically, you know, one half of the Christian population in the world is going to be infuriated by this idea that without the consent of the victim, the person is sterilized. And for that reason, you know, it's immoral in terms of you should at least tell a person what's going to happen to him.
Does this latest of Dan Brown's novels have kind of the mystery of ancient or, what shall we say, esoteric symbolism?
No, for once it doesn't. I mean, as you well know, Dan Brown seems to worship symbols. They're always there. His hero is Robert Langdon, who is a professor of symbology, would you believe, at Harvard University. In actuality, there is no such chair, whatever. And there are always the symbols that have to be, the puzzles that have to be unlocked, and so on. There's a little bit of unlocking puzzles in the latest offering, The Inferno, but it's not central to the case, as was The Da Vinci Code.
What role does Dante's Divine Comedy play in this, if at all, a la the title of the novel?
Yeah, indeed, this is where the novel gets its name, or Dan Brown selected the Inferno section of Dante's Divine Comedy. This is, again, as I say, this name, the novel. Giotto did a map of Dante's Inferno, and this then becomes not the symbol, but the puzzle of the codex that has to be read, or the lock that has to be unlocked. And so by following Dante's survey of hell, in this case, we have the key to unlocking the mystery of how, again, the virus is going to be spread across the world and so on. It's one of the things that clutter the novel quite a bit in terms of the twists and the turns and the plot. You know, you almost have to have a dictaphone next to you or something to remember the cast of characters, because the ins and the outs, the twists seem to be more mandatory than ever, it seems, in so many of today's fiction. Just like the movies, you know, for a good old-time flick, you know, that leaves you with a happy ending and good location and character development is no more. I mean, it's got to be, how can you out-shock and how can you out-special effect the previous movie so that you get an even bigger audience? So this seems to be happening also in the writing of fiction, unfortunately. And so some of these plots get so twisted that it's really hard for anybody in a first reading to keep them straight, you know, until they're twisting so hard that they burst the bounds of credibility. And this is a prime example of that.
Dan Brown has sold a lot of books by casting Christianity, and in particular the Roman Catholic Church, in the most conspiratorial light he possibly can. Does he do the same in Inferno?
He does less of that in Inferno. As a matter of fact, it's only the big moral problem as to whether it's okay to have you and the hero agree in the novel that it's okay to sterilize one-third of the world's population without their knowing it. And I don't think that's moral at all. But this is the only time that Christianity is really attacked. I think he's run out of targets to attack in Christianity, having done the terrible job he did in the Da Vinci Code, in which it's hard to figure out the Christ that we know in these pages. It's an amazing book, that Da Vinci Code, negatively stated, in the sense that every time Jesus or Christ or the church is mentioned, it's a falsehood, misinterpretation, or a lie. And I've never seen a book like that. I mean, every last statement is wrong. And here he has this pious approach with which you began the show, in which he says, no, I want this to be real in every case. I want a person to walk into a church and realize it's a real church. That's fine. I wish he'd have done the same thing in the streets of Paris that he couldn't even get straight. Or Christianity, in which he is so misinformed on every major council in the history of the church, on Michelangelo's famous Last Supper. You know, even anybody with a shallow appreciation of counting numbers, if they can count to 13 or 14, they can disprove the whole thesis of that novel. In the sense that if you have Jesus at the table with 12 disciples, how many heads should there be in the picture? 13. But Brown argues, of course, that Mary Magdalene, Mrs. Jesus, you know, took John's place to the right of Jesus, so John had to go to the end of the table, in which case we should have 14 heads at the Last Supper. And next time you see the beautiful painting, count the number of heads. There are only 13. Some say that John had too much wine, drunk himself under the table. But fortunately, Michelangelo has a tablecloth not going to the bottom. Count the legs. Sorry, they're only 26. And so this kind of thing happening again and again. It's just what you do, Todd, if you want a bestseller, all you do is create controversy. Controversy is the mother's milk of sales. And therefore, how to get a lot of sales? Well, you attack the greatest institution on earth, which is the Holy Christian Church. We are the number one. That's why we're the target for these kind of things. And this is, therefore, he takes on the church itself. With 2 billion, 300 million Christians across the world, it's the number one phenomenon of anything that's ever happened on this globe. And therefore, attack it. The controversy has resulted in 35 books as a result that to counteract it. One of them's mine. I should talk. but it's simply the pattern. It's the formula for bestsellerdom. Controversy, the mother's milk of sales. And so that's the reason Da Vinci Code did so much.
It's not a religious book. There's no religion in a book, nothing. It's all about history. He was personally insulted that the temple was being used as a place of commerce. And not only that, he was upset that the Jews were taxing, overtaxing, and extorting the folks. That's the crux of the killing Jesus theme, is that there was a reason he was executed. Not that he was saying he was God. Droves of people said they were God. But now, when you interrupt the money flow, now you're into territory where they got to get rid of him.
That's Bill O'Reilly of television fame, also author of Killing Jesus. And I promise you, Dr. Meyer, I'm not trying to get your blood pressure up, but what do you make of his claims that his latest book, Killing Jesus, is all about history?
Isn't it amazing how they all want to touch base with the fact, don't they? They all claim to, again, write objectively and tell only the truth. And one of the things that outraged me the most about Dan Brown, I know we're new paragraph here, but one last thing. He once said in a TV show in New England that if he had it to do again as a history of what he's writing about in the Da Vinci Code, he wouldn't change a word. I kid you not, if I would have been in that studio, I would have lunged for his throat, I'm afraid. As a historian, I cannot stand a claim like that. Now we come to Bill O'Reilly. Well, you know, what a bully pulpit he has. In other words, he can move his own book on his own show. No wonder it's a bestseller. And never mind that here we have a layman who knows very little about history, delving into an area for which scholars have studied all their lives, and Bill O'Reilly proudly says, I spent eight months researching this book. It's almost a laugh. Here we have an example of cherry picking. Sure, there are sections of the books that are of the book that are honest and authentic, and other sections are worthless because he cherry picks his evidence. He violates Scripture again and again wherever he can. Jesus said only two things from the cross and not seven last statements. They were only groans and grunts because a person cannot talk when he's crucified. Well, that thesis is, of course, totally wrong. There's no reason that you can't talk when you're crucified, especially early on before you no longer can breathe. But if you can breathe, you can talk. And so that whole thesis is wrong. He claims the other statements of Jesus, the five that he didn't mention, are not historical. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And so this incredible selectivity, you know, and the claim that Jesus was illiterate, for example, that doesn't work. That's also Reza Aslan's claim later on in his book on the Zealot. I don't know what's happening lately, but all of a sudden we find four or five or six books born that have some kind of bestsellerdom attached to them, and they're all put-downs on the historical record and the typical Christian record, which is historical. I guess the whole idea, again, is violate history, come up with something fresh that nobody's seen before, and then you get a reading audience. And Todd, the thing that worries me is not that Christians are going to be shaken by this unless they have a very shallow faith. But it's the marginal people. It's the religion shoppers. It's those who are looking for an excuse not to believe, which will come across with this literature and then be shaken by it. I mean, people have lost their faith because of a novel, The Da Vinci Code. Now, this isn't a novel, of course. It's supposedly a documentary in the case of O'Reilly's book, but the same thing happens.
Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We'll take a break on this Thursday afternoon, December the 19th, reviewing the books Inferno by Dan Brown, Killing Jesus by Bill O'Reilly, and in a few minutes, Trace Aslan's book called Zealot, also claiming to be an historical treatment of Jesus. Dr. Paul Meyer is professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University, author of a review of Dan Brown's Inferno in the latest Christian Research Journal, and author of numerous books, including his latest, The Constantine Codex.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
He Has Made Him Known, a Christmas sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
The true God is not a God that will be found as a result of our God-seeking. He will only be revealed as He looks for and finds us. This is what was happening when Jesus was born.
And for any size year-end donation, we'll send you a CD of this sermon and a sermon preached by Todd on the conversion of Paul. You can make an online tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Rocking around the Christmas tree.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
It's the most wonderful time.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell.
Tired of an endless loop of pop Christmas music? Coming December 24th, sacred music for the Christmas season. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Serenity. Stability. Solemnity. Lutheran Public Radio. Sacred music for the Christmas season. Coming Christmas Eve at LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We're reviewing the books Inferno by Dan Brown, Killing Jesus by Bill O'Reilly, and in a few minutes, Raisa Aslan's Zealot. Dr. Meyer, what do you make of Bill O'Reilly's premise in the book Killing Jesus, that Jesus was crucified not for theological reasons, but purely for kind of economic reasons?
Well, that's not a new thought. E.T. Sanders' books emphasize the economic aspect. And, of course, it was at the beginning of Holy Week where Jesus decommercializes the temple and so forth. And so all the Sadducees are ticked off economically. But I think they should emphasize also the fact that Annas and Caiaphas and people like this were worried about the messianic pretensions of this person from Galilee that didn't believe his account at all, that he was the Messiah. And so they're worried constantly about messianic type of insurrections. And so I think the political aspect should be considered as well as one of the main drivers. So you have many reasons why the prosecution on Good Friday, you know, many of them were acting in ignorance and in good faith as far as they were concerned. I think we should remember that, too. But I think it's more than the economics. I think they're more worried about messianism.
Now, one of the things that Bill O'Reilly has claimed about his book is that this is kind of the first time that anyone's really ever sat down to ask these questions of the historical record of Jesus, and he's going to get to the bottom of things. You know, the journalist slash historian he is, he's going to get to the bottom of things here. Is there any new ground broken?
No, really not. There's no new ground, as I often like to say in works like this. What is written is not new, and what is new is not accurate. And so there's, again, I don't know why he arrogates to himself, even, by the way, on some TV shows, he arrogates to himself the idea that he was inspired just as the gospel writers were. He was inspired to do this. And, of course, if he was inspired, then why doesn't he deal with the resurrection? I mean, this inchoate story of Jesus does not stop on Good Friday when he dies on the cross. You got to remember, he's 43 more days, as it were, 42 more days on this earth. And how come so many lives of Jesus shortened to this very important segment? What happened after Good Friday and after the resurrection? Even the Hollywood versions and Oprah Ammergau versions, they always have, you know, 2.5 hours of, you know, you remember Mel Gibson, you know, back when he had a reputation. He does The Passion of the Christ. Well, here we have 2.5 hours of agony and then 20 seconds for the resurrection. This is wrong. This is misplaced. And Bill O'Reilly does the same thing. He considers the resurrection an allegory. In other words, it never really happened. And so we have, once again, a humanistic view of Jesus, which cuts off any thought of anything miraculous or divine. And so it's just more of the ultra-critical lot when it comes to evaluating Jesus. Very disappointing.
This attempt to dig through as much as possible the layers of legend and mythology, of interpretation and faith that have arisen around Jesus the Christ, and to get to Jesus the man is, I think, important not just for the historian, but I think also for the person of faith.
That's Raisa Aslan in a recent interview about his book Zealot with PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Dr. Meyer, what is the premise of Aslan's novel about Jesus?
Well, all Aslan has done is resurrected the old idea that Jesus was a zealot. Now, this was first brought out by S.G.F. Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N, Brandon, a British author and New Testament scholar, who operated from the premise that Jesus had 12 disciples, and one of them was Simon the Zealot. Aha! Therefore, a member of this subversive group, and if therefore he was a disciple of Jesus, he must have infected all 12 disciples and Jesus as well. And so Jesus now is pictured as the radical revolutionary, out to overthrow the Roman government. And, of course, many people expected a political Messiah at the time, and they thought Jesus might be that person. So once again, he is now saying that Jesus was that person. And this, of course, is nothing new. This was an idea abandoned even by the author to some extent. When S.G.F. Brandon was on his deathbed, he said, I think I've overdone it, you know, in terms of Jesus, the radical revolutionary, the zealot, simply because it doesn't work. There's no evidence, whatever, that when Simon the Zealot came on as a disciple, that he continued his zealotry. One verse in the Bible gives the deep six to this idea that Jesus was a zealot when he tells Simon Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane, put that sword into its sheath. Those who take the sword will perish by the sword. That is his clear no to any political zealotry or revolution in his own lifetime. It just doesn't work. And so we have nothing fresh here at all. But we do have the curious picture of a Muslim who's now writing about Jesus. And that's the reason he's gotten so much media attention. Oh, how quaint is that? Oh, how different is that? You know, here's what angers me about our double standard today, and that is, try the reverse. Have a Christian theologian write a put-down on the Prophet Muhammad. You know, he'd be lucky to get out of the studio alive. And this wretched double standard that we have today, when Christians deal with Muslims, they have, you know, two hands tied behind their back, but the opposite is just pick away at the Christians. In fact, it's a double standard that I find blanket society as a whole today. You know, the double standard goes something like this. You dare not attack anyone else's faith unless it's Christianity, then help yourself. And so that's the reason I think that Christians ought to be more ready at this point to fight back a little bit, you know, to resist this kind of thing and point out how fallacious all these ridiculous attacks are on the faith, which are illogical in most cases, at best, and outright lies at worst.
Before we let you go, Dr. Meyer, we've been talking about these three books that purport to deal with matters religious or to the issues of ancient history, things like that. Why should a listener to us right now buy your novel, your latest, The Constantine Codex, this Christmas, and not Dan Brown's novel, Inferno?
Well, I cheerfully say that in my novel, every place is authentic, and the characters are not. I cheerfully say this is my own creation, have a lot of fun with it. What would happen if the earliest Bible in the world had 67 chapters and not 67 books, I should say, instead of 66? What's that 67th book like? I'll give you a hint. It begins this third treatise, O Theophilus. And, you know, Luke, first gospel, first treatise of Theophilus, book of Acts, second. And the third one would be second Acts. What happened to Paul when he got to Rome? And so it's a lot of fun, but it's a novel, and I tell the reader it's a novel. The difference between my historical novels, however, Pontius Pilate and Flames of Rome, are they are ultra-historical. Every person in the book really lived. That is his or her name, and I never contradict known historical fact. Only where all the facts quit do I project the dialogue, for example, between Pilate and his wife, and I tell him at the end of the book, the reader, that this is now my only creation in terms of factual material. Todd, truth is stranger than fiction. If only historical novelists, you know, would stay with the truth and tell you what actually happened, you'd be doing the readers a service. They'd not only be entertained, but they'd learn in the process. And that's what I try to do with my historical novels.
Folks, you can purchase the Constantine Codex at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest, professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University, author of a review of Dan Brown's Inferno in the latest Christian Research Journal, and author of numerous books, including his latest, The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, thanks for being our guest.
Blessed Christmas to you, Todd. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about the suspension of Phil Robertson. If you don't know the name, you certainly have seen his image lately if you've been on social media or if you watch any television or go to Walmart. Big beard, kind of looks like a ZZ Top in camo. Well, Phil Robertson is, of course, the head of not only the business but also of the family that makes up A&E's Duck Dynasty. He made some comments to GQ magazine on homosexuality, and he's been suspended from that very, very popular show, and the reaction is unfolding. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist, will join us for the next half hour, and your reaction as well, 1-877-623-6943 or facebook.com/issuesetc.
Noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on the uniqueness of Issues Etc.
I'm delighted not only to listen to Issues Etc., but also to have the privilege of being on the program from time to time. Issues is never afraid to take a stand on the thorny, vexing issues that clutter our daily horizons. And it does so in the name of a solidly based Christianity that doesn't flirt with fads or fantasies. Whereas some Christian programs sidestep ethical and doctrinal questions in our day, Issues takes them head-on in a fearless, responsible, thoughtful manner. Both head and heart are involved when Issues applies Holy Scripture.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns, We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Pastor Dan Kistler of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Pacifica, California. A small congregation on the Pacific Coast just south of San Francisco, we invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation that He won for us on the cross and now delivers to us through His Word, baptism, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about us or for free downloadable sermons, visit our website at oursaviorspacifica.com. God's peace be with you always in our Savior, Jesus Christ.
Thank you for donating more than $65,000 to Issues Etc. in the past month. And with 2 weeks left in 2013, we're $25,000 short of making budget. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift online at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. Send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us at the end of the year.